Okay, so the subject of the talk is spherically symmetric loop quantum gravity, and this is work we did with Rodolfo and a student of his, Miguel Campiglia, in Uruguay. So next slide. So the plan of the talk is the following. We'll do a little bit of an introduction to the whole thing, and we'll talk about setting up spherically symmetric gravity. We'll see how to set up a loop representation, how to do a Dirac quantization for it, and we'll try to draw some lessons from this for more general models. Next slide. So, I mean, motivation for doing this is fairly obvious. I mean, spherically symmetric spacetimes include the Schwarzschild solution and therefore singularity inside black holes, so sort of interesting to see if singularity could be removed, for instance, upon quantization of the loop representation, just like happens in loop quantum cosmology. And there is some evidence from treating the interior of Schwarzschild as a Kantowski-Sachs model that might be the case. So it's sort of interesting to study it in this other perspective, namely doing a spherically symmetric quantization. It's sort of the next obvious thing to try after having done loop quantum cosmology, because it includes at least one spatial dependence. I mean, we've been working on this for the last few months. We haven't finished yet. In particular, I'm not going to present any results for the interior of a black hole yet, although we're working on that, and we hope to have something relatively soon. Something to be kept in mind is that when one deals with models like this one, there's a trade-off in the sense that one can use special features of the model to make the treatment simpler, but the more of these features you use, the less the valuable the lessons for the full theory, because special features don't hold in the full theory, so there's a balance there. And we're going to see today that in order to solve the models, we're going to use some aspects of them that do not appear likely to hold for the full theory, so that's something to be kept in mind. And what we're going to do today is largely discuss a traditional Dirac quantization using the loop representation, and we'll also talk a little bit at the end about this other approach that we've been pioneering, this consistent discretizations approach, and what does it have to say about this model and more general models. Next slide. So first of all, some previous work in spherically symmetric gravity, Berger, Chitrin, Moncrief, and Nutku, and then Fernando Lund and finally Bill Unruh were the sort of first to look in terms of traditional canonical treatment to the case of spherical symmetry. They were looking at a little bit more general case than the one we're going to look at today. They were looking at spherically symmetric gravity coupled to a scalar field. Their ultimate objective was to study Hawking evaporation. That's a bit more ambitious than what we have in mind today. Today we just want to concentrate on vacuum spherically symmetric gravity. For that case, the definitive sort of work was done by Karl Kukash in 94. Now, Karl's paper, if you look at it in some detail, it is very careful treatment of the model. In particular, it doesn't just simply say, oh, let's take spherically symmetric variables and try to do a Dirac quantization, but it actually makes a rather careful choice of canonical variables, such that he separates the sort of dynamical degrees of freedom from the embeddings, and then the sort of quantization is immediate, and one is only left with a dynamical variable given by the mass of the spacetime. There's no dynamics, so one has wave functions that depend on the mass, and they don't evolve. In that sense, one can say that what Karl had done is a sort of micro superspace quantization, because he had essentially treated to a great degree the degrees of freedom of the theory and isolated the true ones classically, and then the quantization sort of falls into place immediately. Here we would like to try to do something a little bit more general, because such approaches, of course, have little in common with what one could hope to do in the full theory, and it's unlikely that we'll be able to isolate at the classical level the degrees of freedom and then just proceed to quantize that. In particular, by using so much of the model, there's no chance that he can essentially say anything about singularity elimination, because, as I said, the wave function is just functions of the mass, and therefore the space-time falls into place as a consequence of that and contains the singularity always. So what we'd like to do today is use less information about the model, that is just impose spherical symmetry, and then proceed with the usual sort of loop quantization program and see what that says. Next slide. So the first thing to notice is that the addition of the spatial dependence makes things, in principle at least, a little bit more complicated, or quite more complicated actually, than in the case of homogeneous cosmologies. Namely, if you just start with, you know, the usual type of metric for spherical symmetry, and introduce appropriately symmetric conjugate momenta that are spherically symmetric, one is left with a theory that has one diffeomorphism constraint along the radial direction and one Hamiltonian constraint, and they have the usual sort of constraint algebra. And what one notices is that there is the commutator of two Hamiltonians that is proportional to the diffeomorphism with structure functions just in the full theory. So what this suggests is that this simple model, although it's quite simple, has the problem of dynamics of the full theory. Namely, one has to deal with the fact that one will have to construct Hamiltonians that reproduce that last commutator there, and that has sort of proved problematic in the full theory, and also has proved problematic for these types of models as well. It should be noted that this problem is absent in homogeneous cosmologies because one has only one Hamiltonian, not one per point, and therefore it automatically commutes with itself, and one doesn't face this problem of the dynamics. Next slide. So, moving into trying to do a more modern treatment using the new variables, this subject has been looked at by several people before, Bengtsson in the 80s, and then Kastrup and Thiemann looked at the model using the sort of old version of the new variables with complex variables. Although the work of Kastrup and Thiemann is quite thorough, and they noted that essentially the variables at the end of the day were real, so it was sort of a precursor of more modern treatments. But then Martin Boyewald and Swiderski did a very, very thorough analysis using a sort of more modern type of setting and variables relatively recently. And the conclusion is one can set up spherically symmetric adapted new variables, so they're written there, the connection and the triad. And then one can do a few changes of variables to simplify the constraints, so that is listed in this transparency as well. There's also a change of variables that is made to sort of have appropriate asymptotic behavior at infinity, and this was again discussed in some detail by Martin and Swiderski, so I'll just quote their results here. So one is left at the end of the day with a theory that has three canonical pairs. By the way, X in this transparency is the radial direction. So one has sort of a connection and triad in the radial direction, and then sort of connection and triad in the transverse directions that, of course, don't behave as connections at all. They behave as scalar fields. Next slide. So the form of the constraints in terms of these variables that were listed before are written here. So one has one Gauss law, one diffeomorphism constraint, and one Hamiltonian constraint. And what we would like to do is we would like to eliminate the diffeomorphism constraint, fixing the spatial coordinate gauge. This is something that several people, including Abai and others, have been mentioning that probably we will have to do in the full theory to try to sort of make contact with more ordinary physics. After all, ordinary physics is never discussed in diffeomorphism invariant way, is really discussed in terms of metrics and other quantities that are sort of have meaning when one introduces coordinates. So more or less inspired by that, and to simplify things a little bit, we're going to fix the spatial coordinate gauge. This eliminates the diffeomorphism constraints and still leaves you a Gauss law and a Hamiltonian constraint. They have a first-class algebra, and they still have structure functions. So this, in spite of this simplification, the model is still sort of challenging. The choice of coordinates we're going to make is that the triad take the value A, which is half the mass at the horizon, so the horizon is set at x equals 0, and one can check that actually these choices of coordinates correspond to the existence of an isolated horizon at that point. One solves the diffeomorphism constraint for the variable Ax, and substituting the Hamiltonian equation, one is just left with one canonical pair. So that's listed in the next slide. The Hamiltonian constraint takes a form that is written there, and the constraint algebra is listed there. So the Gauss law is now an abelian Gauss law. It commutes with itself. It commutes with a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian constraint has a non-vanishing commutator with itself that has structure functions, as you see on the right. So although this model is simplified, it's still challenging. It has still the problem of the dynamics. So in principle, we cannot treat it with sort of traditional techniques. I mean, for instance, we could use the uniform discretizations or the master constraint treatment to deal with the problem of dynamics, but in terms of trying to do a usual direct quantization, we face the same problems as in the full theory here. So this sounds pretty discouraging at this point, because one says, well, this is a very simple model, and you have even simplified further by fixing the diffeomorphism constraint, and still you have this problem. But it turns out that one can do a further trick that is unlikely to hold in the general theory that allows for a traditional treatment. Namely, if you take the Hamiltonian constraint that is written there and you divide it by E phi, it turns out that the constraint turns abelian. So, for instance, if that all immediately eliminates, of course, the problem of the structure functions. It puts us in the same footing as one was in, for instance, loop quantum cosmology. In particular, if one wants to discretize things, for instance, to try to do consistent discretizations, or to try to just regularize the expressions, one can also find that the discretized constraint can remain abelian. And then one can quantize, for instance, the discrete theory using traditional methods, or if you choose the continuum theory using traditional methods. But strictly speaking, once you've done this, you don't need to discretize things to actually construct the quantum theory. We will do it just to make more contact with a consistent discretization approach, but it's not something you really strictly need to do in this model. So to try to proceed with this, let's build a suitable loop representations for these kind of models. So next slide. So to try to build a loop representation suitable for these models with spherical symmetry, we start with a manifold that is a line, so it's the radial direction. The graph, or what is left of the graph and the loop representation, is just a bunch of edges, so graph G is a union of edges. And the only variable that remains that behaves like a connection in your model is the radial component of A. The variables eta and a phi, as I mentioned before, are really scalars. So if you want to build a loop representation for them, you have to use point holonomies, just like people use, for instance, in when treating a scalar field or when doing loop quantum cosmology. What I'll do now is to try to simplify things. I will just build a loop representation for the gauge fixed case we introduced. In that case, there's only one variable left, the phi component of the connection. The other variables are gauge fixed. One can build a loop representation for the full model without doing the gauge fixing. There's no problem. It's just to simplify things. I list the explicit expressions for this case. So now one has a variable that is just a scalar. So one builds a holonomy that is written on the right of this transparency, that's T, which is the exponentiated value of the variable. Incidentally, instead of using the variable A phi, for some reason, sometimes we use K phi, which is up to a factor. Gamma is the emergency parameter equal to A phi. K phi is related to the extrinsic curvature in traditional sort of coordinates. So one builds holonomies of this sort, and one can proceed to quantize using a Bohr compactification on the real line. So the Hilbert space is written on the left. It has n copies, if you have n points on the real line, of the Bohr compactification. So the whole thing behaves like a loop quantum cosmology per point, if you want, along the radial direction. The triad operators are well defined. Below the H is written the triad as a quantum operator and has a well-defined action on these holonomies that is written on the right. And in terms of that, one can also write the volume of an interval in the radial direction. So the classical expression is written sort of the next to last formula there. And the quantum version of the volume is also a well-defined operator and it's written at the bottom of the slide. Later on, we will see that this formula has somewhat unexpected implications. Namely, the dependence of this formula on X and on L Planck will have intriguing consequences at the end of the talk.
Jorge, can I ask you some questions?
Yes.
You had said that when you solve the diffeomorphism constraint, you solved it by solving for AX, and therefore AX was eliminated, I thought.
Yes. Yes.
So but here, AX looks like another true degree of freedom. It enters the Hilbert space. So can you clarify a little bit?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Okay. So In the beginning, you said that you got a graph in the beginning of this transparency number 9.
Yeah.
You said the manifold, you know, there's a graph with a set of edges.
Yeah.
And then the only variable that behaves like a connection is AX.
Yeah.
But this is not a kind of a dynamic, it's expressed in terms of other variables now. Is that correct?
Correct, correct.
Okay. So when you say the Hilbert space structure,
yeah.
The Bohr compactification thing refers
yeah.
to what?
To A phi. So the only variable remaining is A phi. It's a scalar, and therefore per point on the line, you have A Bohr compactification.
Okay. So this whole idea about you know the edges is where is it being used as opposed to just points?
For the simplified model, is not being used. Okay, so we're at the slide that says at the top we can introduce a base of loop state. So just like in usual sort of loop quantum cosmology, one can introduce a base of loop states where the index M now refers to the point along the radial direction. So per point, one has a well-defined loop basis. And the Bohr measure introduced before guarantees that this basis can be done, can be sort of made orthogonal in this way. The well-defined operators now are these transverse point holonomies, again, because they're just holonomies for a scalar variable A phi. They have the action that is written in sort of the middle of those three equations there. And at the bottom equation has the action of the triad per point acting on one of these states in the loop representation. One can do the sort of Tiemann trick for the sort of non-polynomial portions of the Hamiltonian constraint, just like in the full theory and in loop quantum cosmology. And in particular, it implies that the inverse of the triad is a bounded operator, and that's written at the bottom of the slide. And that sort of is encouraging because it might suggest that the singularity and, you know, special things might happen, although at the moment we haven't completed the analysis of that yet. So next slide. In this representation, then, one can write an operator that corresponds to the abelian constraint that we introduced before. Again, as I said before, we're going to discretize things on the real line just to make the calculations cleaner. That's how all these Bohr compactifications per point appear. It isn't strictly needed. In the end, one can trivially take the continuum limit, but it sort of makes the calculations clean. So we take the abelian Hamiltonian, I rewrote it there at the beginning of the slide just to have it in mind, and then write a discretized version of it, where what we have done is we have written the what would used to be a phi in the top expression now gets replaced by expressions in terms of holonomies. That's where the signs appear. So these are our expressions, and in the limit rho going to zero would reproduce the top expression, just like one does in loop quantum cosmology. It turns out that this quantity can be immediately promoted to an operator and can be immediately solved. That is, one can find the states that solve this expression in the loop representation. To do that, one takes the Hamiltonian that one has in the second line there, and one can rewrite it at this expression that is has the square root. So that expression is classically equivalent to the expression of the Hamiltonian constraint in the second line. And that expression imposes an operator on quantum states can be solved, and the solution is written at the bottom of the slide. So these states, functions of k, functions of two little variables tau and a at the boundary, one has to be a little bit careful at the boundary of the manifold, takes this explicit form given here, which is a function of tau and a, the two variables at the boundary, times an exponential of something that involves a function f that is an explicit function of elliptic integrals we can write. So it's sort of remarkable, this quantity, if you apply the operator, this e phi equals plus minus square root, etc., on this type of expression, you get that it's identically, well, I mean, the expression is, the two members are identical. So if you write e phi minus, etc., acting on this, you get zero.
Just, I want to slow you down a little bit.
Yeah.
So tell us again about what is tau and what is A and what is X. And
So X is the radial coordinate.
Right.
That was introduced in the gauge fixing. So XM takes values along the sort of points along the radial direction. at the very, we assume that you're treating a finite region of space that ends at some point at some maximum value of m. And at that point, there is tau and a. There are two canonically conjugate variables at the boundary that appear. And so your quantum states are functions of the configuration variable k phi m in the bulk, and then these two variables at the boundary. And actually, when you apply the constraint on the boundary, a relationship appears between tau and a. Tau and a, essentially, a is 1/2 the mass, and tau is the time at infinity, quote unquote, at the boundary, and they're canonically conjugate variables.
Yeah.
Okay. Hmm? And in the very top expression of the Hamiltonian, the classical expression, you have got x plus a cube, etc.
Yeah.
So how does that work? Why does the a appear there in that expression? I mean, this a is supposed to be just living at the boundary, right? Or
A is a number that lives at, it's a variable that lives at one point, so it's a number that corresponds to 1/2 of the mass of the space-time.
Okay, so it's just a constant throughout the calculation, it's a dynamical variable.
It is a dynamical variable at one point, so it's
It's
a dynamical variable that at the end has no dynamics, so it's a little bit convoluted to say, but I mean, it's the mass of the Schwarzschild spacetime, which of course is a constant at the end of the day. It's just that during the treatment, you treat it as a variable.
Right. So, but x is a coordinate and a is what this extra dynamical variable that you have.
At the end, yeah.
Okay.
So on the next slide, what we say is that what we're getting here, the bottom line, is one is recovering the same quantization of Kukac. Because if we go briefly to the previous slide at the bottom, what you see is that the quantum states, this exponential there that appears, is a given function. Okay, so this is just given to you. And the only degree of freedom that is left in the theory is this quantity C of tau A. So this is just an arbitrary function of the two variables at the boundary, and that's precisely what Kukac was getting in his quantization. So let's go back to the next slide now. So one has one remnant of a constraint on the boundary, and that defines this function C of tau A to have this explicit expression there. So at the end of the day, you're left with just one function of one variable, the mass, just like Kukac had before. And this has no dynamics. The dynamics is fixed. So we have essentially recovered, in this language, the same quantization that Kukac had. So now one might ask, well, but what you've done there is you represented this constraint that you had in the previous slide and solved it in the connection representation. You ended up with a function, one well-defined function of k, or the configuration variable. Can one find a solution in the loop representation? It turns out one can do it. We take the same expression we had in the previous slide, this E equals square root, etc., and rewrite it a little bit as this expression in the bottom. These are classically equivalent, those two expressions. This bottom expression can be easily promoted to an operator in the loop representation, and that has been written in the next slide. It's this operator here. And what one can find is, states of these mu's, which were the states in the loop representation, and the Hamiltonian constraint corresponds to this recursion relation. And I always like to say that if you squint your eyes and look at it, it recalls very much the recursion relation that one gets in loop quantum cosmology, in the sense that it connects the variable sort of with four-row separation. One can solve this recursion relation. I didn't write it here because it's just a lengthy expression. But what is rather nice is that if you look at the bottom formula of this slide, one can actually transform the state that we had of, on the right-hand side, psi of k, that expression involving the elliptic integrals, etc. One can transform it into the loop representation and show that actually it solves this recursion relation on top. So the whole picture is consistent. One can quantize the model in the connection and the loop representation, and one can introduce a loop transform between the two solutions. As you see, the recursion relation connects values of the variables at the points m with these sort of four row of separation. That implies the existence of super selection sections, so there's a periodicity in the functions that appears there. The occurrence of this recursion relation that reminds one of the one loop quantum cosmology is suggestive. It suggests that perhaps in the same sense as the singularity in the Big Bang can be eliminated, maybe it can be eliminated here, but again, we need to look at this in some more detail to confirm that. Next slide. Okay, so how does, up to now we have carried out a sort of traditional Dirac quantization. The price we had to pay to do that was to abelianize the constraint, which can be done for this model. But as we mentioned before, that is perhaps unlikely to hold in more general models. It might hold in some more general models, but it's unlikely we'll be able to do it in general. So what would have happened if we hadn't abelianized the model? What could have we done? So we could have, for instance, used this new approach that we have been looking at for a while called the uniform discretizations. I'd like to give a brief impression of what that would have entailed, okay? So again, if you had chosen not to abelianize the constraints, we wouldn't have known what to do in terms of traditional quantization. However, we could have tried this approach. So to briefly recall what the approach was about, these uniform discretizations consist in discretizing the evolution equations as is written there. So one writes any variable A in your theory as evolved through the exact evolution equation written as a power series on the right. And the quantity H that does the evolution is the sum squared of the constraints that you have in your theory. So this has sort of parallels with a master constraint program. These discretizations have desirable properties. For instance, this quantity H is automatically a constant of the motion, and therefore, if I choose the quantity H, which is the sum square of the constraints, to be small initially, and you evolve, the constraints remain small all the time. So one has control among the evolution equations of the values of the constraints throughout the evolution. So this is an improvement over previous treatments in which we didn't have control over how the constraints evolve. So the main challenge here, therefore, is to construct this quantity H that is similar to the master constraint except in a discretized context. So to quantize any model, but in particular the model we're considering here, one will have to construct this quantity H. Next slide. So the main challenge, therefore, is to implement this H as a quantum operator and checking that zero is in its spectrum. If H is zero, it means the constraints are being enforced exactly. So this is exactly the same as one does in the master constraint program. Now, just like in the master constraint program, we know that one might face difficulties when trying this. One might find that H doesn't have zero in its spectrum. First of all, there is something additional here with respect to the usual master constraints, and is that when one works with discretized theories, there is a significant level of ambiguity in how one constructs things. And of course, depending on how one chooses to construct things, one will get different expressions for this operator H. So the criterion that we use to choose which discretization is the best is the one that sort of minimizes the minimum possible value of H. If we chose that discretization criterion, what we would be led to in this model is to the discretization we already presented, because in that discretization, H is automatically zero. When the constraints are abelian, like the ones we have here, we can prove, there's a theorem, that this approach is entirely equivalent to a Dirac quantization. So if one had applied this method blindly in this model, and one had used as a guidance that I want to achieve the minimum possible value for the minimum eigenvalue of H, one would have been led to the quantization I described before. So there's nothing inconsistent in this picture. But we could try to use this model to probe what would have happened if we hadn't achieved that. Suppose one hadn't found a discretization where zero is an eigenvalue of H. What would have happened? So in the second paragraph, I'm just repeating what I said before. In this model, the best discretization would have been the abelian one we presented. You would consider H such as zero as an eigenvalue. And the method would coincide with the Dirac method, so it's essentially the same thing we did before. So what we would like to illustrate, however, is what would have happened if this wasn't possible, like we expect the situation to be in more general models. Suppose one cannot find a vanishing eigenvalue of H. To probe that with this model, one simply has to build a different discretization than the one we constructed, one that doesn't abelianize the constraints. And then one can evaluate the minimum sort of eigenvalue of H, of this new H that one constructed, using the states that we had for constructed explicitly for the abelian model. If one does that calculation, generically one gets an expression like is written here at the bottom. Namely, one gets a power series expansion in both the Planck constant and in epsilon, the sort of separation in space. And what one observes is that this expression doesn't have a quantum continuum limit. That is, if I take the continuum limit, epsilon going to zero, but not the classical limit, so I keep L Planck finite, that expression is ill-defined. On the other hand, the expression does have a classical continuum limit. That is, if I take epsilon going to zero and L Planck going to zero, the expression actually does converge to zero. So this illustrates generically what one would expect in more general models. Namely, one will have a discrete theory that classically approximates the continuum theory very well, but quantum mechanically, one cannot take the continuum limit. So one will live with a discrete quantum theory that somehow will contain states within it that approximate the classical continuum theory well, although one cannot take the quantum continuum limit. And what was done here is to show an explicit example of that, okay? So we can tell you what C1, C2, C3, et cetera are for this particular model if you choose an H that is not abelian and evaluate it on the states that are abelian. The reason we do that, of course, is because doing the real calculation, which is to find the minimum eigen state and eigenvalue of H, generically becomes a hard problem. It's a problem in quantum mechanics, but it's a hard one. Namely, it's like trying to solve a solid state model. I mean, it's not a simple calculation. So generically, even for a simple model like this, you'll have to tackle it using some sort of approximation, for instance, variational techniques or numerical methods. That seemed like an overkill for this model. So in lieu of that, we presented this sort of half-done calculation, which is listed there, which is take the H that is not abelian, evaluate it on the states that we found exactly for the abelian theory, and see what sort of result one gets. And one gets this result we have here. Let's go to the next slide. So I mentioned that the expression for the volume that we obtain implied a sort of an interesting observation, and this is what I wanted to discuss here in this last slide. Namely, when one deals with these transverse holonomies that one constructs for treating scalar fields, like in loop quantum cosmology, there isn't a terribly good motivation to keep the parameter rho, that is the parameter that appears in the exponent, to be finite per se. Well, one normally argues is, well, in the full theory, we know that what appears in the exponent is the length of a loop, and because areas are quantized, one expects that quantity to have a finite value. And using that argument, one can obtain a sort of an argument to lead to a minimum possible value of this parameter rho. This was done, for instance, in loop quantum cosmology. So we assume that one makes the same sort of argument here, that these transverse holonomies allow a minimum possible value of rho, and that can be sort of read from the full theory, and it's at the bottom of this slide, rho of c, square root of c over 2. And the interesting observation here is that if you act with one of these transverse holonomies on a spin network state, what you find is you start with an eigenstate of the volume, and you finish with an eigenstate of the volume that are different, that have different values of the volume, and the increment in the volume you get is written there. This delta V is 4 pi rho, the minimum value of this parameter in the holonomy, times the emergency parameter, times x along the radial direction, times L Planck squared. So this is a kinematical observation, so it's just an observation about the states in the kinematical Hilbert space and how they change when you act with a holonomy on them. Now, generically, whatever dynamics you build for your theory, it will involve this holonomy, and therefore it will involve making changes in the state of at least this minimum value in the volume, but not smaller than that. So therefore one can view this increment in the volume as a sort of elementary building block for building any volume in the theory. In particular, if you consider a shell of a given width and you look far away from the origin, otherwise one has to correct expressions a little bit, so one is looking where the metric is asymptotically flat, what one finds is that per for a shell of width delta x, one has n elements of volume per shell. So you take the volume of the shell and divide it by this elementary volume. And the number of elementary volumes grows as the area of the shell. So if you assume that the entropy per elementary volume is a finite number, what this is telling you is that the entropy of a region, of spherical region of radius B or A, grows like the area of the region, and therefore implies the Bekenstein bound. If you plug in the usual values for sort of the emergency parameter, that expression there was C approximately 1, and rho, as we said, moderated from the full theory, this minimum value and the parameter of the Hammi, one gets this expression for n that is written there in the square box. So this is an intriguing sort of observation. It says that the kinematics of loop quantum gravity in spherical symmetry, the kinematics in the sense that any dynamics you put on it will not affect this, implies the spatial Bekenstein bound. Namely, if you have a spatial region of a certain bounded by a certain area, then the entropy in this area would grow as the area of that region. Notice that it sort of makes sense that, I mean, so you want to say, well, but this sounds like it's only going to happen in spherical symmetry, right? After all, this expression for the volume that you got is really deeply tied to this model that you're looking at. And the answer is, I think, yes, because it is sort of known that the Bekenstein bound, if you're not in spherical symmetry, is not as simple as saying that the entropy of a volume grows at just the area. One has to do introduce other assumptions, and in particular, the spatial Bekenstein bound is known to be violated in several examples. One will have to do something very different if one wanted to sort of obtain the Bekenstein bound in a more general situation. So it's sort of fitting that in the spherical context it arises, and it arises tied to elements that only hold in the spherical context. Anyway, let's conclude here. So on the next slide, the summary. So the summary is that one can study spherically symmetric spacetimes using sort of loop quantum gravity. You need to use special features of spherical symmetry to do a traditional Dirac quantization. The setup, as you saw, is ready. What we need to do is to sort of generalize it to horizon-penetrating coordinates to be able to make statements about the singularity. And I'm particularly intrigued to finish this to say how the statements one make compared to the quantizations that people have done using the sort of Kantowski-Sachs isometry inside of the black hole. I mean, those quantizations have the limitation that the isometry only holds sort of inside the black hole, whereas here, if one introduced coordinates are horizon penetrating like Kukash did, in principle one would have a quantization that is valid all across the space-time. So it would be nice to see it would serve as a way of validating the Kantowski-Sachs quantization if they agreed with it. So I'm sort of intrigued to see what happens there. Now, without using special tricks that are sort of available only for this model, the problem becomes hard, and it offers a promising arena to test these new ideas for handling the problem of the dynamics, be it the massive constraint or the uniform discretization. Some people find this disappointing. They say, well, it's such a simple model, how could it be hard? But again, you have to keep in mind that when you're not using special features of the model, you expect the model to become more and more closer to the full theory, and there we do expect the problem to be hard. So I'm not sort of depressed by that fact. I mean, one has to think about it for a while. I mean, the initial reaction is to say, well, suddenly you made this model too hard, but you make it too hard because you make it look like a full theory, and that you expect to be hard. It is interesting that this holography and this Bekenstein bound can be connected with sort of the basic elements of loop quantum gravity that are the most robust in the theory, namely the kinematical structure, and that this can be done irrespective of the dynamics. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Okay, let's start discussion and questions. But to be kind of a little more systematic, let us divide the questions and comments into three parts. First, we can discuss the first part of Jorge's talk, which is really about loop quantum gravity, and the second part about the discrete techniques that they have used, and the third part is comments about the holography and so on. So let's begin with the first part, which has to do with the spherical symmetric model in loop quantum gravity. satisfied. Any questions or comments?
I have one question.
Yes.
Because your techniques are very much similar to what are used in loop quantum cosmology. In loop quantum cosmology, there have been very strong lessons that it very much depends how you discretize your geometrical variable. So it was not very clear to me how you have done that, but it seems to me it's very much similar to what was done in the old loop quantum cosmology papers, where what is called rho was called mu naught, and that was constant. And the lessons from the physics in loop quantum cosmology is that this theory doesn't have a nice classical limit. It actually, and it also doesn't give right quantum gravity at Planck curvature. It can give at even at low curvature. So my first question is that can you slightly elaborate on that? That what, how, for example, the area of the loop which you have constrained, which makes rho fixed, how it has been done? And secondly, if your model will go through if rho is not a constant?
So first of all, we have to remind ourselves that we're not looking at the area of large curvature here. So it might be that when we do that, we learn the same lessons as you did in loop quantum cosmology, namely that rho has to be different. But I agree that this sort of looks like the older version of loop quantum cosmology.
Because my feeling is that this is also very much strongly tied to the third part, which Abhay said about the holography and the Bekenstein bound. I'm actually, I'm not very sure whether N will be proportional to area if rho is not a constant. Like, so maybe the results will change there. But I completely agree, like in the low curvature regimes, it's very difficult to see. And maybe when you do the full calculation in whole curvature regimes, then it will obviously become clear that rho cannot be a constant.
And actually, it would be extremely interesting. It would be extremely interesting to see if the by getting the sort of large curvature regime right, one gets different implications for the Bekenstein bound. I think that would be very nice.
So my gut feeling is that it is going to happen. Like if, because the lessons what we learned in LQC was that if you do change from mu naught to a variable mu naught, almost everything goes through, and almost all the expressions are very similar. But you just have to change the mu naught to some function in the end. And if the same thing goes through in your model, and if one just buys the equation for n, which you showed in the second last transparency, then n is not going to be constant. And I think that will have very interesting implications.
Right, but it could happen in various different ways. So one could, for instance, have that in the asymptotic region far away, it does hold, and then it doesn't hold in the regions of high curvature, for instance, or not.
Yeah.
That is a very good comment.
So I have a question about the your comment, Jorge, about the horizon penetrating coordinates.
Yes.
Now you the only place where you did some coordinate fixing here and was when you did gauge fixing to solve the diffeomorphism constraint. Am
yes.
I correct about that?
Yes, but we also chose a coordinate system that is not sort of well behaved near the singularity, right? It's not. I mean, we chose the isotropic, the traditional Schwarzschild coordinate, and therefore we don't expect this choice to be good for discussing the interior. So we have to do a different one.
So, but then the statement would be that one has to sort of more or less start from scratch, isn't it? Because you will have to sort of see what the if you use a different slicing, which is horizon penetrating, then you will again have to write down your connection in the triad in terms of these coordinates and look at the components and again try to gauge fix the diffeomorphism constraint and so on.
Yes.
The other question was about, you began with this comment saying that that somehow there is a similarity with what Kukash did. Actually, not began. At the end, you said that there is a similarity with what Kukash did because your solution is like his solution multiplied by a fixed function of the connection,
yeah.
A5, basically.
Yeah.
So from here, it would seem that that the conclusion about singularity resolution then would be the same as what Kukash had.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, you also mentioned that whereas Kukash could use horizon penetrating coordinates, you have not used them. So I'm a little bit confused here.
Well, so what you said is entirely correct. We haven't used horizon penetrating coordinates. The conclusion we get in the exterior is analogous to what Kukash got. On the other hand, one is not in the regime where any of the interesting features of loop quantum gravity would play a role. So several, you know, limits and other things you can take in the exterior, we don't expect to hold when you get close to the singularity, and there's where new things could happen.
That's good. Okay. Are there any other questions on the first part of Horace talk? Yeah.
Jorge, in your expression, you had this mass. So if you said that to be negative, does anything break down? Or is there something in the formalism which tells you that the mass is always positive?
Not off the top of my head. We're just looking at the exterior, remember. So.
Okay.
Well, but mass is the same as, up to a factor of 2, is the same as little a, right?
Yes.
So if I looked at your Hamiltonian constraint, then there are all kinds of things like x plus a in the denominator. And I would think that if A was allowed to be negative, then at the place where x is equal to, you know, when x plus A is equal to 0, the framework would not work. So therefore, it is implicitly assumed, actually, I think, that mass is positive, or A is positive.
Yeah, I think we have to look at it more carefully. I mean, we haven't looked at the case, so it might be very well right what you say.
Okay.
I mean, in the Kukash treatment, at the end of the day, he just has a function of the mass. So, but it is true that one can, it might introduce singularities elsewhere.
Right. I mean, in the intermediate steps, one might have to assume that this A is positive. Otherwise,
right.
Okay. So let's discuss the. Any questions or comments on the second part, which had to do with this discretization, uniform discretization? Okay, so there's one more question in the first part. Let's get back to that.
Yeah.
Jorge, are you thinking of somehow imposing these asymptotic boundary conditions? I know in this talk, I think you mentioned that you just put infinity to a finite point. But in the classical theory, the boundary conditions, right, for on these variables. And one question has always been, how would you impose these in quantum theory?
No, I think that was taken care of by Martin and Zwiderski when, I mean, I went a little bit fast about that part where they do some changes of variables such that asymptotically they behave properly. So that was taken into account.
I see. So your E phi doesn't have any non-trivial asymptotic behavior?
No.
I see.
Okay, so that was Madhavan who is visiting here.
Yeah, I recognize that.
Right, okay. So let's have any comments or discussion about the uniform discretization scheme. I would like to go to transparency 15, Jorge.
Yes, I'm working on that. So which one is that? What's the
15? That's the one which begins with the main challenge
as
an equation.
Yes.
So, I mean, this right-hand side has only 8 terms or finite number of terms?
Yeah, it has a finite number of terms.
And is there any reason to separate out the first 3 terms as opposed to the last ones? And they seem to have the same form to me.
They have the same form, but we wanted to emphasize what the limits, you know, A and E going to 0 is.
Right. Okay. As a side remark, here Alex Corici and Paramprit and I have been also thinking about the similar questions in the context of loop quantum cosmology, because these were somehow sparked by work of Jose Antonio Zapata and also Alex Corici about polymer particles. about what would happen if one takes continuum limit and so on. And our conclusions are very similar to your conclusions here. I think because our system is simpler, we can do much more detailed work. But the conclusion was that, yes, that quantum mechanically, one, in this case, one cannot really take the continuum limit. If H bar is not equal to zero, if the Planck length is not equal to zero, the loop quantum cosmology equations do not have a continuum limit. And so some discretization is really is needed, and the discrete theory is qualitatively different from what one would obtain from the V-relativity theory. Now, at some heuristic level, one knew all that thing. It's just been put much more precisely.
Yeah, I think all these results are confirming what people, you know, hand-waved for years, but now one can do a calculation.
Right. So maybe you can say what which people hand-waved, I mean, just for everybody else's.
Do you want to start?
The hope was that somehow, because of quantum geometry, there was there would be qualitatively new effects, and the fundamental discreteness is really essential, and there is a basic difference between doing, say, loop quantum gravity in the continuum, so to say, and doing the lattice gauge theory and then taking the continuum limit. I think that is what people have been saying, and that in loop quantum gravity, finiteness is coming because of some fundamental discreteness, and it is just incorrect to take the continuum limit. Is that the kind of thing you had in mind?
Yeah.
Okay, so if there are no further questions on this part, let us just go quickly to the last part, which is the Bekenstein-Baum-bound observation. We already had a little bit of discussion. But I would like to understand, I mean, the various things here, namely, we're looking at a thin shell, and we're looking at the area of that thin shell. But for this n, I see on the right-hand side b squared minus a squared. I didn't know exactly what b was, but somehow, is it correct to say that b squared minus a squared is precisely the area of this thin shell, and delta x is precisely the thickness of this thin shell?
Yeah, so b is the exterior radius, and a is the interior radius of the shell. So if you take a sphere now, a is zero, and n goes as b squared, as the radius squared.
Okay. Any further comments or questions?
I'm sorry, what more?
Yeah, there was one more comment, just one second.
So this is on the same slide with the next slide, 16. In your formula for delta V there, you have it proportional to rho, but also proportional to the spatial coordinate x.
Yes.
So if we look at large values of x, we can get an arbitrarily large jump in the volume. And at least to me, this seems kind of unphysical in a way, and might be an argument to think of why rho might be non-constant. So perhaps scaling is 1 over x would give you a jump in V that would be constant and on the order of maybe the Planck volume, for instance.
Yeah, certainly if rho changes with X, that could happen. By the way, this formula is not new. This formula was new in this context, but a similar dependence on the volume and X was sort of heuristically introduced by Eng and used in for various sort of things in papers that he discussed, you know, limits of computability, limits of measurements of space-time, and so on. So it's exactly the same formula he gets. So it's sort of remarkable that heuristic formula that had been floating around somehow is validated by this model.
But would you think it makes physical sense that at large values of X, that the jump in V is quite large?
In spherical symmetry, it definitely makes sense. You might want to ask if it makes sense in the full theory, and there I'm not sure, and that's why I made those comments at the bottom, namely that I don't think the Bekenstein bound is true in the full theory, perhaps.
Thank you.
So that was Kevin van der Sloot. Okay, any other questions?
I recognize that too.
Okay, so if not, let's thank Jorge again.
Thank you.